welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. And you're taking off like a bird, as my dad would say, for Florida?
Yep.
What you going to do down there?
There's a little race down there, the Daytona, I guess it's called this year it's the WeatherTech Daytona 24-hour race.
Yeah, I don't know about watching cars going around in circles for 24 hours. I know it's not just an oval track, but geez, it's so noisy.
Yes, it is. That's the
he's smiling.
That's the good part.
No. Well, I hope you have fun down there. And I know it's going to be warm, and I know I'm going to be envious, but I just won't think about that.
Well, we'll road trip next year, right? There has to be a cycling event somewhere down there we can cover.
Well, there's certainly beaches and beach chairs and, you know, Bloody Marys and all kinds of stuff.
And portable recording
equipment.
We have the technology.
We do. I want to remind our listeners of a couple of things. First, if you tried to hear the show on WJCU 88.7 FM at 5:30 last week, it wasn't there because we are now at 6 p.m. So the show now runs 6 to 7 p.m. in between our buddy Joe Madigan and actually the guy who edits our show, Dale Armbruster, who does a sports show after us at 7. So we apologize if you missed it last week. You can always go back and hear a previous show at WJCU.org. Just kind of click on the Outspoken Cyclist, go to the show you want, and you can download it and stream it right from your computer with a click of a mousey.
And if you subscribe at iTunes,
you can.
It updates and refreshes right there whenever you want it.
Exactly. And all you have to do is like look at your phone or look at your mobile device, your tablet, and there it is. I think WJCU has a mobile app too.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, so you can get it right there. Second, watch out. It's coming soon. The 2016 Radiothon is less than a month away. We just want to remind you that we're going to be hovering around your door asking for your support. So as we say, give early and often and support your favorite radio show. That would be us, right?
Yes, it would be.
Yeah, okay. I want to give a shout out.
Who is it this week?
One of our favorite people.
Well, I have a lot of favorites, so...
Betsy Andreu.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. She was featured in an article in Inc. on Inc.com, I-N-C, by Ian Jackson. He gives us a glimpse into the mind of Betsy Andreu. The article is titled, Six Key Lessons from the Woman Who Refused to Back Down from Lance Armstrong. And all the lessons listed are well worth reading. It was really a well-done article. But number six especially, I thought was excellent. Number six reads, the majority are often wrong. If there is just one lesson you should take from Betsy, it is where this article began. The majority are often wrong. And if you are certain of it, just like those great minds who actually profited from the collapse of Wall Street, sometimes you just need time for everyone else to catch up to you.
Yes, and I'm often in the catch-up mode.
You know, she's turned into such a huge force for good in our sport.
Yeah, she very easily could have just gone away and disappeared and not done anything. And we're so thankful that she's done what she's done.
And still doing what she's doing, still giving back to USADA with the young sports work that she's doing. So we should probably move on. Last week, as you know, we spoke with Jay Townley. He was a 58-year veteran of the bicycle industry. And we learned about the history of the retail segment of the bicycle market. I still think that was one of the more interesting history lessons I got about the Schwinn Total Concept Store.
I just look at how far ahead of the times that Schwinn was with what they used.
In many ways, I think you're exactly right. Well, this week, our first guest is also a true veteran of the bicycle world. He sports 12 Canadian championship gold medals.
12?
12. He has over 100 professional race wins. He was the member of two Olympic teams, although the team for 1980 didn't compete, as we know. And he went on to make Pearl Izumi a household name amongst almost every cyclist who has ever donned a pair of 8-panel black padded shorts or a screaming yellow jersey or jacket. So I have to give Hugh Walton a lot of credit for the screaming yellow color that you see everywhere now, everywhere. So today, Hugh is about to launch his new model in cycling apparel with a unique understanding of how the markets have changed and what the customers want, how manufacturers are going to need to change if they're going to want to stay viable and keep up with what's happening out there. After a break and some news, we're going to talk with Brian William Davis. Brian just launched his fourth, count them four, successful Kickstarter campaigns. His fourth one was like completely funded within the first, I don't know, 48 hours or so. This time it's a product called the Weatherneck. His inspirations often come from what annoys him when he's riding his bike, and his wisdom about how crowdfunding works might just encourage or discourage you from taking on the challenge. So let me introduce you to one of the real pros in our cycling world on so many levels, Hugh Walton. I also would like to let our listeners know that Hugh had a stroke 3 years ago, and his speech is sometimes a bit halting, but I think what he has to say is worth the listen. Hugh, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks, Diane.
Well, you have had a long and illustrious career in the bicycle world, and that would be even a gross understatement. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Can you give us a bit of history, early history, where you were born, where you grew up, and where you went to school?
Great question. I was born in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm a Canadian citizen, and I started racing in 1972.
That's a long time ago.
Cycles. Yeah, exactly. I'm 61.
Okay.
So.
And then where did you go to school up there?
Yes, I high school was Neil McNeil High School in Toronto. We had to wear uniforms.
Wow.
All boys school. Yeah. Sorry, I rode my bicycle to the school in my uniform.
Well, that's okay. I think kids still do that today. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, the priest didn't approve.
Aha. Did or did not approve?
Did not.
They didn't like it that you rode a bike?
I wore my uniform on the bicycle.
Oh, that was the no-no. Okay, well, I don't know. So I want to... So, yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I went to... after high school, I went to York University in Toronto.
So I think I told you this, that my daughter got her master's from York University in Toronto.
You did?
She
in
did.
In what field?
She is. She got a degree in screenwriting.
Oh, fun.
And
great.
She met her husband there. And he is from Belleville, as in triplets of Belleville.
Sure, of course. Awesome.
See, small world. So
exactly.
So I want to talk a little bit about your racing career. You raced for and in Canada, and you just have just an amazing career. Tell us about your racing background, the Canadian national team and all of that.
Well, I started racing in 72, and I made the national team in 73 and went to the raced with the national team in 74 and went to Worlds in Belgium in 1975 for the track. And then, of course, the next year was the Olympics in Montreal, 1976.
Oh, that's right. They were right there in Canada.
Hometown. It was nice.
Yeah.
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 I raced the team pursuit.
And you have 12 gold medals?
Well, various events, including pursuit, team pursuit, and other such events. Yes.
So there's a question I didn't think to ask you before, but I'm going to ask you now. Did you race during the same time as Steve Bauer, or did he come after you?
No, we were close teammates.
Yeah. He came to Cleveland once to race on a velodrome here for a couple of days. And were you here for what they called Bike America?
I did a couple of races in Cleveland. And I'll tell you a story about Steve Bauer. We went to the 1977 World Championships in Venezuela. And there we had the team pursuit team assembled. Steve flew into Venezuela directly from Austria, from getting seventh in the Junior World Championships. He just showed up. It was awesome. He was very important to the team. Super strong.
He was a big guy, as I remember.
He was stocky.
So, where's the track? Where's the track that you raced on up there?
In Toronto, it was in Montreal. It was a part of the Olympic venue. It was huge.
Oh, it was a big track. Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome.
And then you went on to ride in two Olympics, including, and I want to talk about this because you rode in 1980 and the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Olympics, but you were there and I don't know anything about it.
No, I'm sorry. I was not.
That's weren't.
No, my bad.
Oh.
So I was saying I made the team, but the team never went.
Oh, they boycotted it too?
Well, yes, that's correct.
Wow. So solidarity.
Followed, exactly. That's right. Canada follows USA.
Wow. How interesting.
It's too bad. So, I was in such great shape.
Yeah. Too bad. I think our team was in good shape, too. It's too bad.
Yes, I think so.
It's too bad. What kind of bike were you riding in those days? What was your track bike?
Great idea. This is a tough word for me.
Okay.
Marinoni.
A Marinoni.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's what my son-in-law rides.
Oh.
He has one.
From Montreal?
Yes. Yes.
Hand-built.
Yes. Yes.
Great.
So I would like to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Hugh Walton, and his speech is a little bit unclear sometimes. Hugh had a stroke, 3 years ago?
4 years.
4 years.
Now.
And so they repaired the problem in your brain, but it did affect your speech.
No, Diane. Oh. Here's the deal.
Okay.
The damage in my brain is permanent. But the damage to my heart that could have caused another stroke was repaired.
Ah, okay.
So the stroke is what it is, but my heart is good.
Are you able to ride?
Oh, yeah. I ride all the time, a lot.
And you're riding with Michael King.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, on Saturday, we were planning a big group ride in Boulder from to Carter Lake. It's about 85 miles.
Wow. That's a big
nice
ride.
Nice group.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's good. So, yeah, I'm fairly fit. I'm pretty strong.
Well, you look good. See, I can see him. He can't see me. We're on Skype. And he's laughing right now. Yeah.
I am.
So, how do you see pro cycling today? Obviously, you follow it. We're going to talk about the work you do and the work you've done since you were a cyclist, a pro cyclist. But I just like your opinion on today's riders and teams and just the way cycling's going today.
Well, after the last few years, I'm encouraged on the drug scene. However, with that said, it's likely that the sport is still drug infested, likely. I think the science is ahead on the rider's side. I think microdoping of EPO is probably prevalent. Probably. So I'm encouraged, but I would say the sport is much, much cleaner than in the past. Much.
Yeah. Did you see that the UCI? No, the Olympic committee only allowed two American road and time trialists for Rio?
No, I did not see
that. Yeah, only two each. It's really weird. The way they do it is weird. Anyway, so I'd like to leave pro cycling here and talk about the long career you had on the supply side. So you really, when I think of who Hugh Walton is, I think of Pearl Izumi. I mean, you are Mr. Pearl
right.
Izumi.
Was.
You were.
Well, very quickly, I'll explain. I rode for Pearl Izumi in the 1982 Coors Classic in Colorado. And Pearl Izumi at that time was owned by David Jacobs, the owner of a Spider Skiwear. So after that, after my racing career, I took a job with the Raleigh Bicycles and moved to Seattle. When I was up there, David called me and said, "Hey, Hugh, can you come down to Boulder and run Pearl Izumi for me?" I said, "Sure." I didn't think 2 seconds for that. After a while, Diane, David realized it was not going anywhere. He thought it was not going anywhere. Sold me the company for $1. $1.
What a great story.
Well, I helped him unwind the company. He said, "Hugh, I'm going to do a Spider. You do a Pearl." And we went our separate ways there. So the rest is history. That was 1988. And I did that to 1995. During that period, I raced as a Masters. I won the Masters Road Race National Championships 4 times during that period.
Wow.
And the World's Road Race in Austria once. It was a fun time.
Yeah, I guess. Well, you know, I was a Pearl Izumi dealer really, really early on. I can remember, I'm trying to remember, it was Dash America at first, and then there was something.
That's correct.
There was something called, was it the Cool Seat? There was a saddle. Do you remember that saddle? That cool.
Well, what it was actually David had a brand called Cool Gear.
Okay. Okay.
And Hot Gear. But that went away. But yes, Pearl Izumi had saddles with flow.
That was it. Okay.
That was it from ski boots.
Wow. Well, they certainly became a huge, huge influence. I mean, they're still big. Although Shimano, does Shimano own Pearl now?
Yes, that's correct. I left Pearl in 1995. And subsequent to that, that company was sold to Nautilus in Boulder. It was, you said, Dash America. That was the licensee for Pearl for North America and Europe, in fact.
Yeah, they had,
so keep going, please.
They had some really interesting fabrics. And you remember like those jackets, everybody has one of the Pearl Izumi yellow jackets.
I'll tell you, Diana, I remember you very specifically. You encouraged me to keep the neon yellow. I remember this clearly. You were very insistent on that.
And
no,
you
no, keep
did.
The neon yellow.
And you did.
We did. It was huge.
It still is
and
huge.
That fabric at that time was the first microfiber called Silmond.
Silmond, that was it. Yep.
Yes, from Teijin in Japan.
Once again, I'm talking with Hugh Walton. He's back in Boulder, Colorado, and we're talking about the good old days in some ways. Tell me what you think has happened between the retail and supply channel, how it's changed in the last 3 decades. So I would buy from Pearl Izumi. Pearl, you know, your reps would come in. People like Michael and Rick Harnish would come in and they'd show me the line and I'd, you know, either tell them, yeah, I like this or I don't. And you guys would ship product. It's just not like that today.
It's a much, much bigger business. So, yes, Diane, the whole process is changed to benefit the dealer in one bad sense. Most companies sell against the dealers. That's not fair. But they have to sell online. The whole economy is going online, as you know.
So how do you see the deal? What do you think the dealer needs to do to stay viable? Because I think service is still viable, but you know, I mean, a big part of our business was apparel and footwear,
yes,
and helmets and you know, accessories, and all that stuff is a commodity online now.
Right. I think are you familiar with a company called Proper Cloth?
No. Wow.
Oh yeah, they make dress shirts to order quickly and 3 weeks turnaround. I think the whole cycling apparel industry is going there. everything's going to be very, very micro-oriented, very, very specialized. Not the bicycle company, but
yeah,
the you get it.
I do get it. I think it's a really interesting idea. If somehow it has escaped me until now. How are you staying involved? What are you doing now?
Thanks for asking. I helped to run Descente after my stroke. So that didn't work out. But now I started my own entity called Walton Custom. So my website will be up by February 15. Walton Custom, that's what I'm doing.
And is that going to do what you were just talking about, proper cloth? Is that sort of along those lines, that micro kind of?
Yeah.
Oh, how cool.
I think the ways that this is going to work, a client, a well-to-do client, will go into the bike shop and say, I want a jersey with this logo with my family picture on it, please. The shop will say, boom, you have 3 weeks, $100. So it's going to get very, like maybe somebody spent $10,000 on a bicycle. They want a jersey to match.
Well, people are willing to pay $100 for a jersey now. They're willing to buy ASOS for a lot more than that. So why wouldn't they buy something they want exactly? Exactly.
I threw it $100, probably much lower. I'm sorry. My estimate is too low.
Well, even so, in quantity, I would think if they wanted six of them, that would begin to bring the price down a little bit, or no?
Well, no. Everything is about technology with the bike shops, with logistics and managing inventory. That's everything by computers, and logistics is everything. So, yeah, my factory is investing heavily in digital printers. They are unbelievably fast and accurate, and there's no screens, nothing, no minimums. The minimum is one. So
yeah, so under that, you know, why bother? Exactly. Wow, that is so interesting. So when do you think this will all be up and ready to go?
Well, my company is February 15.
Okay, that's really cool.
I believe in apparel, frames will be the same way. I think factories like Giant, for example, will have to dial down their logistics to be able to fit a client who walks into your shop, says, I need a 56X, and boom, order with special colors. It's happening.
Well, you know, we ran a shop that was custom only, so you would come in, you'd get fit, and we would then design the frame, and then we didn't actually build the frames ourselves. We'd send it to somebody like Seven Cycles or Waterford.
Sure.
But this whole idea of these printers, these digital printers, how cool! You think bicycles will go there eventually?
Well, with 3D printers, yes.
Wow!
Eventually, absolutely, yeah.
So, do you have any advice for a bike dealer right now?
Oh gosh, extreme service, extreme, bend over backwards, and create a culture. Like in Boulder, the shops are very into the culture of cycling. And I would have to say Rafa has done a great job there in the culture of cycling. And Boulder Cycle Sport here in Boulder, they have a team, a club, it's huge. So foster the youth through a team. Absolutely.
That's a great idea. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I would love to come out and see the Boulder cycling scene sometime. I haven't been to Boulder in years and years and years. And I have a really good friend. Well, besides you and Michael, I have really good friends out there who have been there for decades. So maybe someday we can all get together and sit and talk about this. But I want to watch for it's waltoncustom.com, right?
That's correct.
All right, we're going to watch.
Up and running by February 15.
That
right
is
now
so cool.
Is that website is under construction.
All right.
Well, so, hey, Diane, I'd like to do the jersey for you. So
Well, you know what? We will have a conversation about that. The Outspoken Cyclist would love to have a jersey with a name on it. That would be great. Hugh, thank you so much for talking with me. It is so good to hear your voice.
Thank you, Daniel.
All right. You have a good night.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye. Goodbye. Well, 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 well. Hugh Walton. And please excuse the speech. He did have a stroke 4 years ago, but you know what? He hasn't lost anything. It's all in there.
Yeah, it's all in there. And the neat thing is he is ahead of the curve as far as anybody is concerned in running businesses and everything else. And I think his phrase of extreme service is something that it doesn't matter. I don't care what your business is.
Right.
That's exactly what you need to do. And I think it's great that he's on the cutting edge with providing, a bike shop, another opportunity for them to come in and offer another service for the cyclist or anybody who's just a friend of a cyclist.
Well, it's like Jay Townley said, you know, you have to create the experience, the experiential. It's just such an interesting conversation. I know I've known Hugh for years, and yet I don't really know him. But I forgot about the thing about keep the neon yellow. It's funny that he remembers that. And I am sure I said it because I absolutely have always believed in it. I probably ordered, if I ordered 10 jackets, 8 of them were neon yellow.
Well, guess what color the neon jersey is going to be for the Outspoken Cyclist?
I guess it is.
Maybe we can see that we can get you for that for your trip down south.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fun? All right. Well, Hugh Walton, I really appreciate him taking time to talk with me today. So we need to take a quick break. We will be right back on the Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And this week, the news was full of great videos. So some of the videos this week were documentaries. One is called Tainted Blood, The Untold Story of the 1984 Olympic Doping Scandal. And another was a BBC interview with, and I hope I get her name right, it's Zahala Samas. She's a teenager in Afghanistan who is defying the taboo of girls who aren't supposed to ride. So if you are interested in seeing some interesting documentary, and I think Tainted Blood, you may have to get a special sort of password and log on to watch it. I'm not sure if it's coming to a theater near you. But you can see the BBC interview with Zahala Samas. Just type in her name. It's Zahala Samast. Really interesting interview, and her English is impeccable.
Better than some of ours, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Title from cyclingweekly.co.uk. The title is "This is Why We Don't Need Disc Brakes."
Okay.
I don't know if you, I know this would excite you, but I don't know if you saw the picture or not. Despite the UCI's disc brake trial continuing into the second season, there's still plenty of nervousness among the pros about the possible dangers of the new technology. And this nervousness was certainly shown in the response of this photo of Andre Cardoza's close call at the Tour de Saint-Louis. He actually posted this picture on Twitter, and the photo shows a nasty injury on the inside of Cardoso's thigh where he got tangled up with a chain ring in a crash.
Oh, chain ring, not a disc rotor.
Right. So you can imagine what it looks like if you took a chain ring and just...
Oh, I've seen it happen.
Right, exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
However, despite there being no disc brakes involved in the crash, a number of pro riders picked up on the photo as highlighting the possible dangers of disc brakes during mass pileups.
They're sharp. They are like razors.
Dimension Data's Nathan Haas retweeted the photo with the caption, "Why we probs don't need disc brakes," but he received criticism from some users trying to use an injury by a chain ring to highlight the dangers of disc brakes. So there were discussions back and forth with what that was on Twitter. However, as nasty as the Andre Cardoso injury looks, this was far from the worst crash we've seen in recent days, with Andrea Malori in a medical-induced coma following a separate crash at the Tour de Saint-Louis, while Jayne Alpecin's riders were seriously injured in a crash at a training camp over the weekend. Yeah. So the technology, which is the disc brake, may create some of these problems, but we still keep having all of the crashes and everything else that's involved with it. So the question is, do we need one more thing to happen when we're going to continue to have the crashes?
Know. Maybe what we should do is, for everyone we bring on, we should get rid of one.
Okay, so what do we get rid of?
I don't know. You could do belt drive for instead of chain rings. Ooh.
Well,
the problem there, though, is it's only one chain ring. You can't get multiple front gears.
But a lot of people are switching to that, to a single chain ring, right?
Well, so carbon fiber belt might work.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
We'll
that was
on
just
that.
One of my off the top of my head. You know, I'm sure my engineer, Brian, would come up with all kinds of reasons why that wouldn't work. And he would probably be right, because he usually is. Okay, though she's leaving her position as CEO of Camelback, Sally McCoy has some great advice for women in the outdoor industry in a great story on snoozenet.com. So Snooze used to be the sort of paper version of what's going on in the outdoor industry. So Snoozenet is the online version. And I want to read a little bit of it. It was written by Cassandra Clues and Kristen Hostetter on January 20th. When Sally McCoy was 10 years old, her father asked her what she wanted to do when she grew up. Quote, she says, a ranger, because it was the only job she knew at the time that would let her work outside. I thought that was cool. That's good, she recalled her dad saying at the time, because it'll probably still be a man's world when you're grown up. She said, that pissed me off.
That was enough.
She never did become a ranger, but at 23, after a barrage of rejection letters from outdoor companies, some of which she still has, because you need to keep those to remind you to stay sharp, right? She landed her very first job in the industry as a mail clerk, M-A-I-L, at the North Face at a below poverty level wage. 5 years later, she was the vice president.
I like those kind of stories.
Yeah, me too. She picked an industry. She picked a company. She got in the door, said Ann Crick, the North Face's senior director of brand communications. January 9th, Crick presented McCoy with the Outdoor Industry Women's Coalition first ever Lifetime Achievement Award at the nonprofit Standing Room Only Breakfast. Few people have done more for the benefit of our industry than Sally McCoy. She's held leadership positions at nonprofits like the Conservation Alliance, the Outdoor Industry Association, and the Outdoor Industry Women's Coalition. And although she's too humble to applaud her own success, she has been a brilliant fixer and grower of companies. She turned Sierra Designs around in the early 90s, in part by launching an innovative line of women's technical apparel and sleeping bags built from the ground up, instead of the shrink it and pink it stuff that was common then. You know what? It's still kind of common now on some levels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both were first for the industry at a time when women's and unisex meant exactly the same thing. Some at Sierra Designs accused her of, quote, ruining the company, unquote, with her new women's line, Sally recalled. But when we made better women's clothing and gear, we got better at men's too. So the article is long. It is excellent. It's on Snoozenet, SNEWSNET.com news. The real McCoy outgoing Camelback CEO, Sally McCoy. And congratulations to her. I wonder what she's going to be up to next, because she ain't done, I'm sure.
I don't think so.
No.
And the interesting thing is, I remember being in grade school taking one of those tests that determines what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah, I never did one of those.
I was supposed to be a forest ranger.
And here you sit.
And here I sit inside where it's nice and warm and
right, exactly.
Dry, and there's no bears and there's no...
Right, exactly. No skeeters.
And, yeah, and
skeeters.
My idea of camping is setting the tent up inside the Hyatt somewhere. That's about the extent of it.
I got it.
So we're always excited when we talk about new sponsors for race teams, and
yes,
we know
we
how
are.
Important the sponsors are.
Okay.
So I was kind of surprised when I saw this in Cycling News. Former Smart Stop riders owed nearly half of 2015 contracts.
Oh, isn't that Eric Marcotte?
Yes, it is. So Team SmartStop's rise from Criterium Squad to the upper echelons of U.S. domestic road racing was swift and thorough. But the team's collapse was even more abrupt after the self-storage company that had been title sponsor since 2013 was sold, and the new owners weren't interested in renewing the sponsorship. Now former former Team Smart Stop riders have told Cycling News that the Premier Sports Group, which owned and managed the Continental Team, stopped regular contract payments just over halfway through the year, leaving the riders struggling to recoup the money they're owed. Premier Sports Group manager and co-owner Jamie Bennett confirmed to Cycling News that the management company owes riders and staff the back pay, saying that he's continuing to working to make everyone whole. At the end of the day, we're going to get each one of the riders about 95%, Bennett said. Between the bond money and the money we have coming in from some final liquidations on stuff, we'll get everybody 90% within their next 45 days, and we'll have a little bit to clean up after that. So,
what's going to happen to the team going forward?
I noticed that they had picked up some other sponsorship.
Okay. But
the
they're not going to want to take on
reformed.
That debt.
Right. They're not going to take on the debt. There was an interest, and this is, again, a longer article, and the interesting in there is with one of the cycling organizations, there is a bond that must be paid by
that.
The teams.
Yeah.
And they're hoping that they're going to be able to get some of the money back from that. But I think here's a case where, you know, SmartStop was doing an awesome job as a Continental team, and I can't imagine, and I'd love to hear the stories later on from the riders, how halfway through the season they said, okay, you need to keep riding, but you're not going to get paid.
Well, Eric and I have had a conversation right over the holidays that he's getting ready to come back on the show, and maybe he'll be willing to and able to discuss it. I don't know if it's going to have some legal ramifications he's not going to be able to say.
Right, and I think that adds just so much more to it, you know, besides all the other crap that you have to deal with in riding.
Right.
The fact that you're not getting paid for your job.
Right, exactly.
How many of us would be willing to continue to do that for half of the season?
Not many. Not many could afford to.
Exactly.
All right. So, you ready to ride cross country?
Yes.
Oh, sure you are. Ram announces 2016 qualifying races. Four new races have been added to the 2016 calendar, growing the number of Ram racers. So this comes out of Endurance Sports Wire, one of my favorite places to get news. Denver, Colorado, 2016 marks the 35th year for Race Across America, the world's toughest bicycle race. Ram is an iconic American event. Riders from all over the world come to race 3,000 miles coast to coast across the U.S. The race is a life-changing experience for racers and crew. Ram is open to solo racers as well as 2, 4, and 8-person teams. Racers must qualify for solo Ram by completing a Ram qualifying race. No qualification is required for teams for Ram. Whether you are trying to qualify for solo, working on developing your skills under race conditions, or simply looking for the next ultra racing experience, there are 34 Ram qualifying races to challenge you, 25 road races, and 9 time trials. The races will test your limits. There is a list of all of the qualifiers for the road races, and then there is a list of the time trials. The dates are based on the most recent information that they have. For more information, go to raceacrossamerica.org.
This is one of those events that I really wish more people were able to pay attention to, or just aware of. And,
right.
And maybe like we talked before with the advent of more video, this might help out, because this really is an endurance event that is not anything I'd be interested in, but it's amazing to see the people that compete.
There are a lot of people here in Northeast Ohio who have either crewed it, raced it, and completed it, or, you know, team, individual, whole bunch.
I think that's just that's a really neat event.
It is.
Jayne Alpecin's John Degenkolb could be out of action for 3 months, leaving the defense of his Milan San Remo and Paris Roubaix titles in doubt. John will be out of competition for 3 months, says the doctor that operated him following a head-on incident with a car. The prognosis means that the star will effectively miss a shot at defending his titles in the spring. A British woman drove into him and 5 teammates head-on in a training on Saturday near Alicante. There are 2 riders that are still hospitalized. The American Chad Haga is also in the hospital. They were lucky to be as close to Valencia as they were. That allowed them to get to the hospital quickly with what everything was. And he had 3 hours of operation, and they're looking at April 23rd as the date that he'll be able to that's the date that they're expecting he'll be able to start competition again, and he fully expects to come back at 100%.
That would be nice.
Again, simply a training ride, and we've talked about all the other things.
You know, that's
before.
Like the most accidents happen 5 miles within 5 miles of your house. You know, the stuff happens on training rides all the time.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk with Brian William Davis about his Kickstarter campaign. You're listening to the Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head on over to Appleton, Wisconsin, and talk with Brian William Davis about his new product, the Weatherneck, and a lot more. Brian, thanks for joining us on the show this evening. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Diane. I appreciate it. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, you know, when you see an image of somebody on Facebook who's wearing a full cow outfit, I mean, it's so bovine. You know, and then you're a genius. It's sort of like I didn't quite get it. But so, you know.
We all wear that in Wisconsin. Didn't you know that?
Oh, that's right. You're in Appleton.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and I've been to Appleton many times.
Nice.
Well, I was married to somebody from Appleton. And the operative there was. So I haven't been there many years. But yeah, he was born and raised there. I know you were not, though.
That's a beautiful town. I was not. No, that's true.
There, Lawrence University is there.
It is. Yeah. And I live like 3 blocks away from Lawrence.
Yeah.
It's a great city. I love it. And I moved here to Wisconsin maybe 15 years ago, something like that. Met my wife, moved up here. I love it. I think it's a wonderful place to live. So
it's a beautiful little city. Yeah. Yeah. I used to like to go downtown and used to go walk in this park that was right by the river. Is that the Fox River?
Yes, it is the Fox River. You are absolutely right.
All right. So
I was just riding my fat bike down those trails moments ago.
Yeah, I know exactly where they are. Probably I can picture them in my mind. That's really funny. So, you know what brought me the attention is about the new product you've created called the Weatherneck Outdoor Bandana.
That's good. I'm doing my job if you heard of it then.
Well, and I have. And then when I started doing some sleuthing, I found out this is your fourth successful Kickstarter project. So let's start with the bandana because that's the current one. It is way more than completely funded. It is way overfunded. Tell us about the product and then a little bit about how you came about getting to that product because it's very different from the other products you did.
It is. Yeah, I don't and I guess I'll explain how my process works because people are like, "Wait, you did this and now you're doing that?" It just doesn't make any sense. And but we'll get into that in a minute. But as far as the Weatherneck goes, the concept was I wanted to just be able to have a little bit of fabric around my neck without overdoing it. I think so many of the ones that I came across or tried to use in the past are just way overbuilt. And even living in Wisconsin and riding in some pretty nasty weather, once I get going, I don't need massive amounts of windproofness and all these things around my face. I just need a little bit of warmth around my neck. And mostly I want to be able to take it off because a lot of times once I got going or the sun would come out or the wind would change direction, you'd start to overheat. And this is exactly what happened on my ride about an hour ago. I got to the trails, was freezing, and as soon as I rode the trails, I warmed right up.
And then
all I wanted to do was get that thing off my neck. And that's where the whole concept came from. It's just to be able to rip it off quick. And, you know, what I sort of noticed in the past and even today was just taking that fabric off your neck seems like it's taking off like 4 layers of clothing. It regulates so much temperature that comes out of that neck area. It's you get a lot of bang for the buck from being able to put that on or remove that as needed.
Well, what you haven't mentioned is the reason it is not just that it's lightweight and that it's thin, it's how you attach it and detach it.
Yeah, with my first couple prototypes, it's obvious to want to try Velcro, and I did, but it was real nitpicky on how you could pull it off. You had to do it at a very particular angle, and it got dirty, and when I'd go to stuff it in my jersey pocket, it would scratch up my jersey, and as you know, those jerseys are not cheap, so I quickly moved into magnets, and one of my other products had some experience with magnets, so I had a bunch laying around the garage and started sewing magnets. Well, I taught myself to sew. Sewed some magnets in and just started getting one step closer. And then in the end, I finally just figured out if I just want to increase the strength, I just get bigger magnets or smaller magnets, and off I went. And that really changed things, because then I could get just the right amount of force just by changing the size of the magnet. So that was great. And then I've heard other things that I didn't even contemplate, because I don't have long hair, but a lot of people with long hair have said, this is wonderful. My hair gets tore up in Velcro, so I don't have to worry about this with the weather neck. And then even riding in ice, Velcro kind of has some problems, and you're not going to find those problems with magnets. So, and it also lends itself to a really slick resizing feature that's a much more elegant solution than a big slab of Velcro on the back of your neck.
So did it increase the weight of the product by much?
No. Okay. That's a good question. I would wager that the amount of Velcro that one of those things would use and the weight of all four of my magnets would be very, very comfortable.
Yeah, probably. They're little. I mean, you don't need big magnets to get things to work, right? You just need
opposition.
Yeah,
they're pretty small.
Right?
They're 3/8 inch and 1/4 inch
wow.
high. And they're circle size. So it's about the size of a wheel magnet on your speedometer pickup, something like that.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you can go see it. You can go see it, Weatherneck Outdoor Bandana. It's very clever. Now, it is not available yet.
We're on pre-order stage. So you can pre-order on my website, theweatherneck.com, or you can find it on Kickstarter on our active campaign, and that goes until February 12th. And the pre-order stage is a lower MSRP, so that would be the motivation to do that.
So one of the questions... And in fact, this came up in a conversation Tim and I were having here in the station, is that Kickstarter projects, a certain percentage of them, even when they get funded, stuff doesn't get shipped. Now, you wrote a piece which you sent to me, which I thought was awesome. It's 49 tips. Evidently, you get asked all the time how come your Kickstarter projects are successful. And obviously, you do what you say you're going to do. And I would imagine that would be the number one incentive to deal with somebody like you.
Yeah, I think my track record is pretty good right now. So I've done 4 Kickstarters, and all of them have delivered on time so far. And this one's no different. I approved the final prototypes to start production this morning in the sewing facilities just a half hour from my house. So they should have those done easily within the time frame that I need them. So I think we'll have 4 for 4 on-time delivery.
So do you have any idea of how many people are funding this Kickstarter program who have also funded previous ones of yours? Is there any way to track that?
I'd have to wait till it all comes in and run the spreadsheet, but just eyeballing it, there's definitely a lot of familiar names. And there's a lot of, I email everybody that's supported me in the past and let them know about the new project. So, the first day of my Kickstarters are usually pretty explosive. And then, like most Kickstarters, you'll get a really, really high amount of interest in the beginning. And then in the middle, it's pretty slow. And then in the end, it picks up again. So I've just started the middle section now. So today was pretty slow. But yeah, I get a lot of repeat customers and a lot of comments on my campaign and people saying, hey, I supported you in your past. You did a great job. Exceeded my expectations, stuff like that. And I bought into Kickstarters before, and I've gotten the stuff, and some of it has been good and some of it has just been garbage. And I think my rule of thumb with Kickstarter is, if anybody is doing a plastic mold overseas, there's no way they're going to do it on time, and you might not get it. And that seems to be what trips people up the most, is when they get into doing molds overseas. That's they always overestimate their ability to get that done.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brian Davis. He has just launched his 4th Kickstarter campaign in the outdoor, and I'm going to say outdoor industry, because the Weatherneck could certainly be used for other than cycling. It could be used for skiing or running or anything you want. You can find the Weatherneck Outdoor Bandana on Kickstarter or on its own little website. I want to know, what do you think is so compelling about crowdfunding? I mean, everybody, it's like, send my kid to college, here's a crowdfunding, but obviously it works. Why does it work so well?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of different facets to it. So there's certainly the nonprofit, help a buddy out, so-and-so got hurt aspect to crowdfunding, and that's a whole nother world. But as far as the product side goes, my view is that, and the way that I have evolved to using Kickstarter is to pretty much make my own investments out of pocket to get the product very far developed and get very deep into prototype stages and right on the cusp of production, if not in production, before I take it out to Kickstarter. And that part of that goes back to the reputation thing, is I want to make absolutely sure that I can do what I say I'm going to do, and not have any guesswork. And I learned a lot on my first one. And we were dangerously close to total disaster numerous times on the first one.
was that stressful. The back bottle, or was that, was that?
I'd rather have that stress occur when no one's watching me rather than when everybody's paying attention.
Right. Was that the back bottle? Was that your first one?
No, the first one was the first version of Fix It Sticks. And those were the aluminum orange ones that have non-removable bits. And then the year after that, we did another Fix It Sticks campaign to offer steel sticks that had removable bits, and we also introduced a new tool to the line called the T-Way wrench at that time as well. And then, so those were the two campaigns for Fix the Sticks, and then last year I did a campaign for the back bottle, and then this year I'm doing the WeatherNet. So it's been one a year for 4 years straight.
So are these ideas, do you think that when you come up with an idea, the more ideas you have, the more ideas you have, it's sort of like the more you do, the more you do? Things just start rolling?
Well, I think certainly now that I feel relatively confident in my ability to get people's attention, I have some press contacts that I can send them stuff, and they listen to me because I've done a good job at delivering on time and not delivered junk previously, so I think I have a track record with them. I have a track record with built-in customers, so I know I can sell a certain amount of whatever my next idea is, and I've certainly gained a ton of experience on prototyping and production and talking to suppliers and making sure that I can actually produce the thing that's in my head. I think maybe the ideas don't necessarily come with any more frequency, but my ability to execute on them just gets better and better over time.
Ah, okay. I got it. So I understand what you're saying. That's interesting. Is anybody coming to you and saying, hey, I have this idea, do you want to jump in on it and help me and blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing?
Every once in a while, somebody will ask me that. And, I'm not opposed to it, but it's not something that there hasn't been much of a fit in the past.
Yeah.
More often than not, people just say, I have an idea. Would you run my Kickstarter for me? And that is not a good solution, just because it takes a lot of passion to do the Kickstarter, and there's just no way that I'm going to have the same passion for somebody's product that I would have for mine. So the heart and soul is just not into it. So
yeah,
it'd be a tough fit.
I got it. I know exactly what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying. So the WeatherNet is funded. You approved your prototypes. Do you have another project in the not so distant future? You don't have to tell me what it is.
That's a good question. That's a tough one to answer. It could be tomorrow that I have one. I go out on a ride and I have an idea, and boom, I can figure out how to get it made in a couple of months, and I'll have one ready. As I stand here today, I have a couple little ideas that are probably not interesting enough to do a whole campaign over, and then I have one idea that I absolutely adore and I love, and I've shown it to people, and they love it. But there's some liability concerns with lawyers, so I'm not sure that I want to, like a safety thing, you know, so I'm not,
yeah. No,
not
I
sure
get
that
it.
I'm ready to tackle that.
I get it. I absolutely understand what you're saying. I've been in the bike business a long time. There's lots of things,
yeah.
you know, that liability can pop up and you go, oh, wait a minute, maybe not that.
Yeah, maybe throw the brakes on. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing, like, you know, working by myself out of the garage is, you know, I have ideas, but I'm fairly limited on what my budget is or my skill set is to get stuff done. So I see companies come out with really cool stuff frequently, and I'm just thinking, man, if I had some of the resources they had, I think I could do some pretty awesome stuff.
Have you been approached by any people in the industry saying, come to work for me, or we want your product, like QBP? Do they carry Fix-It Sticks?
They don't, sadly enough, but hopefully we can change their mind. But we have other distributors that carry them. J&B carries them, and KHS, and those guys have been great to work with. So, we've definitely got some distributors worldwide as well. And that's another part of coming up with ideas. Now, I know I have some amount of distribution to put these ideas into. Once I get them out of pre-order stage, I can get them into distribution. distribution and some shop relationships that we have. So no, I haven't been approached to work for anybody, although I'd be interested in that. I think that'd be kind of fun to try for a little while to have more resources to see if I could come up with some more interesting things than just what I can devise in my garage.
So are you inventorying all this stuff yourself?
Yeah, I have a partner in the Fix-It-Stick side of things, and that's been very helpful to me to take care of a lot of the day-to-day business side of things. And then we are working together on the back bottle, and future ideas that I come up with can go over to that shared company that we have together. And then that takes a lot of burden off of me so I can focus on coming up with new ideas. So that's been very helpful.
So this is it for you full time? This is what you do?
At the moment, it is full time.
What did you do before you decided to be this crazy inventor, which I love? I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I love it too. Before this, I did corporate sales for FedEx and DHL, and those were fun jobs because it was a great way to see how companies make money from start to finish. So I would be privy to where they're importing their things from, what they do in their facility here in Wisconsin, and then what they ship out. And it was very eye-opening to see how all that worked for many, many, many different types and styles of companies. So that was helpful, and one of those companies taught me some things about the Amazon business, and then I got involved a little bit with selling some stuff on Amazon, and then I got frustrated because there was so much competition on Amazon that I couldn't continue to have a successful run at a particular product. So I thought, well, if I just came up with my own product, that would help. And I always had ideas for years and years and years, but once I got pretty good at Amazon, I thought, well, maybe one of these ideas I could turn into a product and sell on Amazon. And that was the original goal with all of this, was just to come up with my own product on Amazon so that I could purposely not sell it to Amazon and get shut out. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you talking with me about this. This is just fascinating to me. I have a product of my own. I've had it for 4 years, going on 5 years now, you know, and it took us a while to put it together, and we make it ourselves and blah, 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 blah. And we didn't do any of the funding. We owned a bike shop at the time, so we were able to sort of, you know, finance it. But it's just fascinating to me to see somebody so successful with this Kickstarter thing and be able to talk to you and learn some of the things you've done. It's really, really cool. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me, and good luck. You really don't need it. Weatherneck is already on its way, but good luck with your next project, and thanks.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, and if anybody I can help with Kickstarter questions, let me know, and you're welcome to make those 49 tips available to people as well.
We will do that. We will put that document up on the Facebook page, and that's very cool. It's very generous of you. Thank you.
No problem. Hope it helps somebody.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Diane.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Brian Davis joined us from his home in Appleton, Wisconsin, where he seems to garner ideas near the Fox River.
Yeah, that must be a good place. Maybe we can get that to be the new Silicon Valley, the Cheese Valley, or we can do something. Obviously, if you've had 4 successful campaigns, he's doing something right.
Absolutely. And you know what? Those 49 tips that he offers, you know, some of them are really common sense. You go, well, yeah, but if you don't write them down and look at them, you probably will not think to do them.
Yep.
So we're going to put those up on our Facebook page. I'd like to thank both of our wonderful guests this week, Hugh Walton and Brian Davis. We will be back next week. And maybe even Tim will be back, although he's probably going to stay in Florida because it's nice and warm. Thanks so much for listening. If you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.